This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
So next we'll be in conversation with Dr. Jacqueline Musomi, who looked into how COVID-19 has undermined access to income for women because of the services that you'd find that most women are employed in, including domestic services. So we will be speaking to Dr. Jacqueline about this particular report and what her report has found as well. And then at 11:30, it is our Motivational Friday, and today we'll be joined by Dr. Lulu Kwakwa, who's the CEO of Lireko Investments. Believe me that you do not want to miss that conversation. We're going to be speaking about the corporate world, what it takes to become a board member, seeing that she served on many boards, including AXA. I think she's still with AXA, if I'm not mistaken. She's also been with Sun International. So what does it take to be on a board and to serve on a board? And looking into the conversation that we just had now during during Thought Council, the one that was sponsored by Zingisa, like when we speak about transformation and inclusion, what role is it that boards can play towards that particular goal around transformation as well as inclusion? But for now, as we've indicated, that we are going to be focusing on the report that Dr. Jacqueline Musomi has compiled, looking into how COVID-19 has undermined how women access income. Dr. Jacqueline, good morning and welcome to Power Talk.
Thank you, Arlene. Glad to be here, and good morning to your viewers, your listeners.
Thank you so much for making time for us. What is it in particular that this report was looking into?
So basically, current research on the impact of COVID-19 has shown that the most impacted people in terms of job losses and income loss have been women, individuals with low levels of income, and individuals at the bottom of the wage distribution who mostly happen to be Black. So we wanted to find out, what is it about women that make them so susceptible to job loss and income loss? And so what our study tries to do is unpack the characteristics of female occupations and then see how these occupations are linked to low income and the susceptibility of women to income loss.
Is this because you find that there is, would we say a high concentration of women in the services industry?
Yes, so that's a major part of it. So most women, and especially in South Africa, are concentrated in the service industry. So these are occupations where you deal closely with your clients or the people you're serving or your colleagues. So they are highly interpersonal and manual, and so examples of these are like your domestic work, elementary sales, shopping clerks, personal care, and all these happen to fall in the services sector. And as we know from COVID-19 and what the medical sector is telling us, is that the closer you work with people, if you share offices, if you come in contact with people, then you are at a higher risk of contracting COVID-19. And so what the government did at the beginning of the lockdown was shut down everything. And so the most impacted sector has been the services sector, which holds about 42% of the women in South Africa. And so that's where this effect is coming from.
Okay, so when you look at, for instance, the Constitutional Court, I think it was yesterday's judgment, looking into the domestic workers and why domestic workers were excluded from some of the benefits from the state, including the COIDA. Do you think that there is a dislink between what the state's intentions are versus what's happening on the ground?
Yeah, so some of the positives that came from the government reaction to COVID-19 and trying to help people was the handing out, the topping up of grants and the introduction of some new grants, like the temporary, you know, unemployment grants.
Yeah.
But then what this did not do, it did not mostly go to women. Why? Because, and as you gave an example of domestic workers, for example, so most of the domestic workers do not have your formal written contract. So most of these contracts are usually verbal, and the relationship between the employee and the employer is mostly personal. And so it's very easy for such workers who are in precarious conditions to be let go. And because the lockdown shut down everything, these were the most, the people who were at the most risk of losing employment, because it's not an official written contract. And then something else that makes women so vulnerable is because women are less likely to be employed. So that means you have less women in formal employment. What does that do? Then it leaves them out in the UIF, temporary employment relief. And so we found most women being in this precarious condition of either you lose your employment or you don't even get to access the government support that was supposed to protect women from the effects of COVID-19.
Okay, let's hear your take on this conversation as well on 0861987000. You can also tweet at Aldrin Simpia, hashtag PowerTalk, and also tweet at PowerFM987. Do you get a sense at all as a woman that you have been impacted harder than the men because of COVID-19? It has had a harder impact on you. You can also tweet at Aldrin Simpia, hashtag PowerTalk, and also tweet at PowerFM987. And Dr. Jacqueline, the reason I asked this question is that we went into COVID-19 already knowing that there is a gender pay gap parity that already exists.
Yes.
Yeah. So just taking that into consideration as well, and then you have COVID-19 that happens, and you're saying that there has been a huge impact on the income of women, and already, as I've indicated, that we went into COVID-19 knowing that there is this wage gap between the two genders.
Yeah, so we know that the gender pay gap persists in all countries. And in South Africa, so there are different ways of measuring the pay gap, but the figures we are used to is the average, right? And so the average pay gap is about, so also again, it becomes complicated because then it depends on whether do you use monthly earnings or do you use hourly earnings? Because as we know, women are more likely to spend less hours in formal employment than men. So then what you use to measure this gap matters. But if you use hourly pay, for example, the pay gap used to be around 40% in 1994, and this came down to about 16% in 2014. I don't have the current figures, but if you use monthly earnings, for example, the last figures I have are for 2017, and that was around the 30% figure. And so we already know that these gaps exist. So women are less likely to participate in the labor market. If they do participate, then they are less likely to be employed. Currently, we have an employment gap of about 13%. And then if they do get employment, then they, on average, they will take home lesser pay. So then you have all these things that are, it's a compounding effect. So you have an increase of female-headed households are currently in South Africa. So if you have female-headed households and these females are taking home less pay, and then you have these females are more likely to be living with children, and then so you have women being more likely to fall into poverty, more likely to lose their income. And so we have this precarious nature and risky affair going on.
And what about the race element to it?
And so in terms of the pay gap, so there is an overall pay gap, then there is a race gap. But what is happening is that what we see is because of our history, where we are coming from, we have differentials in education. We have differentials in what occupations Black people are in and what occupations white people are in. Even within occupations, you have differentials in terms of the hierarchy, in terms of what level are you in that occupation. So then these inequalities are persistent over time. And so with COVID-19 and women, the women who are in the most precarious position are Black women who are mostly at the bottom of the wage distribution, who are the highest percentage in this very interpersonal occupations, which have been greatly affected by COVID-19. So you have women in personal care, so those are your hairdressers. You have women clerks, so those are your shop checkout clerks. And we know these are the ones that we have been mostly interacting with and who are in the most likelihood of contracting COVID-19 if they do, you know, if they were in essential services, then they were in a position to be most likely to contract the virus. And so we have this cycle of precariousness that is affecting women and it's not a good picture.
And I see that the report also indicates that from the evidence, it shows that women were more likely to be dealing with what you term the triple burden.
Yes. Yeah. So this is what I was referring to in terms of it's a compounding effect. So what happened with the lockdown is that you could either continue working if you were classified as an essential worker, or you could continue working if your work allows you to work from home. So who are the people who are likely to work from home? So these are your professionals and probably people in management. So the good thing is that, at least for South Africa, with women having an advantage in education, so this has been shown by other researchers, we have almost a 50-50 share in terms of professionals. So we do have women in professional occupations, but then this is a very small proportion of the South African Republic. As I said, most of the women are at the bottom of the wage distribution. But then these women who could actually work from home, the problem is that, as we know from social norms, is that women are the ones that are most likely to be caring for children. And with COVID-19, is that there was a shutdown of schools. I mean, everything was shut down. And so that meant that even if you could work from home, you had to tend to the children as well. And what other research has shown is that this then affected the productivity of these women who were in a position to work from home, for example. So if you and say you have a husband and a wife who are both in a professional occupation, say they are researchers, for example, then if you have the woman focusing on tending to the children and also having to do her research, then her productivity will be lower than her male counterpart who does not have to deal with this other burden. So that's why we are calling it a triple burden, in that you have to deal with your work, your office work, you have to deal with childcare because the schools and early childhood centers are closed, and you also have to deal with housework or house maintenance. So then it's a triple, but you have to deal with all these things and still have to deliver. And if your productivity is then affected, then that indirectly affects your income at the end of the day.
Okay. And what we also find, of course, is women in the informal trade. I don't know if this report looked into that at all. And I'm now reminded of Ugogo. I don't know if you remember seeing the visuals of one granny, I think it was somewhere in Soweto, who was selling acha. And she was shoved into a police van because she was breaking the lockdown regulations.
Yeah, so that is the sad picture. And that's the reality of it is that, so because women's work is so precarious, and then if we have women who are in the trade sector, for example, they are going to be in such kind of precarious trade where you're standing at the corner and you're trying to sell something because then you have to feed your children. But then it also puts you at risk of contracting COVID-19. But then what do you do? You have to feed your children, but then you're in this precarious occupation. And so these people, and especially because they are outside the labor market, then they are not protected with, unemployment benefits because they are not in the formal sector. So then they have nothing to fall back on. So then how then do we value women's occupations? How then do we structure government grants in such that they are able to reach the people that actually do need that help?
So from this research that you've done and looking at some of your findings, do you find that there could have been fault lines as well in how the state, for instance, would have taken into consideration this precarious position that women find themselves in the country?
Well, because my study does not focus on that, mm-hmm. I cannot definitively say what could have been done. But what I'm saying is that from the research, we know that women are less likely to participate in the formal labor market. They're more likely to be in the informal sector. We know that women are less likely to have formal written contracts, and they are more likely to have this verbal sort of contract. Then as you're structuring this unemployment, insurance benefits, when you're structuring temporary employment relief, put into consideration that you have a big chunk of your labor force or population that does not fall into the definition of this grant, and then have a way of helping those people.
So earlier on, when we were having a conversation during during our Thought Council, one of the conversations we had was around transformation as well as inclusion, from transformation to inclusion. And the point that was raised by Zingisa as well is, how do you make sure that even companies are able to respond to the needs of women specifically, and also make sure that you create an environment where women are able to deliver at their best, including, for instance, let's say, do you have a daycare center in the company? So that the woman is able to take care of, so that the child is being taken care of while the woman does the work. And one of our listeners once spoke about, I think it's Khumutso, she once spoke about how HR in its own also needs to be more compassionate.
Well, definitely, Aldrin. So there is need for compassion, and there is need for understanding of who is in your labor force and what is your working condition. So in terms of women being less likely to have formal written contracts, in terms of women being less likely to have medical cover, so we have these women who are in these precarious occupations, who are in the services sector, who are more likely to contract the COVID-19 and who do not have medical cover. And then as employers, we need to be cognizant of that. In terms of working conditions such like having daycare centers, schools having to, make sure that the school calendars is in tandem with working hours. that you don't have to run from your office, go to school, pick your child, drop them home, make sure they have someone to take care of them, go back to the office. You know, all this running back and forth. And previously, what researchers were advocating for was this a flexible labor market, flexible yeah. hours for women, in that you're able to, because the existing wage gap, some of it comes from the fact that in some occupations, say in accounting, in law, your hours are not linearly correlated with your wages. It's, you know, quadratic, it's exponential. So then we have to make it easy for women to do their work from wherever they are, provided they deliver what they are supposed to do. So can we have flexible hours for women? But what COVID-19 has showed us is that even if we introduced these flexible hours and allowed women to work from wherever they are, if we still do not solve the issue of childcare, we have not really assisted these women. Because during COVID-19, as I said before, the women who were able to work from home, yes, it was flexible hours, but then they had their children right there, and then their work became impossible. So we can introduce flexible hours in the offices, but then the government, companies, employers, we all have to come together and find a solution for childcare.
Yeah. And just finally as well, the report indicating that with the easing of the restrictions on economic activities, employment levels have not gone back to the pre-pandemic levels.
Yes. So what research from NIDSCRAM found was that, so because of the hard lockdown, so many people lost their jobs. And of the 3 million jobs that this research found to have been lost, 2 million of those jobs belonged to women. So then, and of course, most of these jobs were coming from, you know, your laborers, you know, say construction workers, people in building, people in, in industries that were not classified as essential. So, and a majority of these were domestic workers. But then when lockdown was eased, then you could see some of these people going back to work. Some of the, first people to go back to work were, for example, domestic workers. So then we saw that, okay, some of these jobs were being regained. But then because so many women lost so many jobs, even with this easing, they still have not been able to catch up with men. So women still remain behind in terms of job losses.
Okay. And what would you say the solutions are now?
So
that's a tough one, right?
That's the million dollar question. But then, there are several issues that could be done. So the one thing is that what we see is that at the bottom of the wage distribution, women have very few options. So if you're a woman who has less than post-secondary education, for example, you can either be a domestic worker, you can be a shop sales clerk, or you can be in personal care. So that's like just three choices of the occupations that are open to you, because most of the occupations at this part of the wage distribution are very male-dominated. So you have manufacturing, mining, agricultural laborers, you know, machine operations, which require manual physical labor that, I mean, unless we can genetically, you know, modify women, this is not something that they have an advantage over. Mm-hmm. So the one thing we can do is, how then do we encourage women, and how do we encourage integration of this sector such that we have more women coming in to this somehow male-dominated industries? And then how do we then encourage our school-going children to venture into STEM subjects. Okay. And then that gives them a doorway into some of these male-dominated, because even in machine operations, for example, we don't all have to be the laborers. You can be the manager. Mm-hmm. You can be, you know, you can do something else in that industry.
Yeah.
So those industries do not have to be strictly male-dominated. We can encourage our school-going children to venture into some of these subjects.
Okay.
So the other thing is something like, so what we saw with minimum wage, it affected this part of the wage distribution where most women were. Mm-hmm. So one of the policies that can help bring up the average female wage without necessarily targeting women is, for example, like the universal basic income that is still mm-hmm. under debate. And then so we have also, in terms of education, how do we then encourage our children to, because even if we are now specifically talking about women, what we saw with COVID-19 is that the people who were at the lowest risk of losing their jobs or losing their income were the people with post-primary education.
Okay. Unfortunately, Dr. Musomi, we've run out of time, but thank you so much for this conversation and making time for us.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.